We're going to continue our studies and highlights in church history. And we're looking at the apostasy of the 18th and 19th centuries. The explosion of apostasy in these last times that is preparing for the Antichrist. It's preparing for the Antichrist in the one world church. It is the devil's mystery of iniquity that is described in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And the mystery of iniquity is the devil's plan to put the Antichrist on the throne of this world. And that's his goal. That's what he's working toward. But the devil is under God's control. And so the devil can only do what God allows him to do. Otherwise, the Antichrist would have come already. But God's not allowing that. The Bible says in 2 Thessalonians 2, he that now lets will let until he be taken out of the world. And so the Holy Spirit, we believe that's the Holy Spirit, who is the only one who could restrain the devil's program, is restraining the devil. God is in control of the times. And the Antichrist cannot come until God allows it. And that will not happen until after the rapture. And all those things are clear in Scripture. It's very wonderful to know the Scripture and to know the prophecies and to be able to understand these times and to understand these movements that we're studying. And so we're studying six major movements of the 18th and 19th centuries that characterize the apostasy and unbelief of those times and which now spread across the world. You cannot understand the present times without understanding history. It's been said that modernism is like ivy. And ivy is very interesting. Many people plant ivy and it will cover whole walls. But ivy grows very slowly at first. It's said that ivy sleeps and then it creeps and then it leaps. And so you plant ivy and it seems like nothing's happened. You come back a week later, a month later, nothing's happened. Sleeping. And then it starts growing, it starts spreading. It has little vines that go out and new leaves and it spread. But it's creeping slowly. But after a while it starts leaping and you can't even control it. You cut it and cut it back and it just within weeks it's grown over everything. And that's what happened with theological modernism and humanism and these things. In the 1700s it started. But it didn't have much influence. It was just among a few intellectuals. And then it started creeping around. And then by the late 1800s, it was leaping. And by the 20th century, it spread everywhere. So now we come to Darwinian evolution. And Darwinian evolution did not start with Charles Darwin, as many think. It started with his grandfather, Erasmus. Erasmus was a famous Renaissance man, the man who published the first printed Greek New Testament, Erasmus. And so Charles' grandfather was named after this man. And in 1794, Erasmus published Zoonomia, or the Laws of Organic Life. And Erasmus Darwin, who was a friend of Benjamin Franklin, all these men lived at that time, Voltaire in France, and Erasmus Darwin in England, and Ben Franklin over in America. They were all scientific men, they were geniuses, but they were all skeptics. And Erasmus came up with the idea that life started in the ocean. Some little life started, and everything evolved from there, out of the ocean. I've been to Erasmus Darwin's house, which is a museum today, very interesting place, in England. Then in 1830, Charles Lyell, who was a geologist, he came up with and popularized the theory that the world was not created in 6 days, and there was no global flood. Before that, almost all Christians, at least, believed in the global flood. He said, no, there wasn't. In fact, the layers of the earth that we see, They were laid down by millions of years of time. And he promoted the geological column theory, which is the fundamental theory of evolution today. This is what they use as evidence for evolution. They say they go to a place where there's a cliff, and you can see the layers, and they say, well, those represent millions of years. Of course, we believe and know that they represented, that they all were laid down during the flood and afterwards, very quickly. That's sedimentary rock that we're looking at. That is rock that is laid down through water that is deformed into rock very quickly. Sedimentary rock. But he said, no, those layers happened over millions of years. And if you look at the fossils, you can see the evolution of animals. Charles Lyell. We read that Lyell was thoroughly liberal in his religious beliefs or disbeliefs. And he proposed to undermine the people's faith in the Bible. He hated the book of Genesis. In fact, his objective was to drive men out of the Mosaic record. Drive them out. So they don't believe Moses anymore. He did a good job of that. And then 1859, Charles Darwin comes along with On the Origin of Species. The North British Review said it was prophetic of infidel times. That's exactly right. It was infidel times. We have described those times. Modernism, Unitarianism, humanism had spread all through England. It was infidel times. Infidel means an unbeliever. And he said, this book by Darwin is the prophecy of these times. It came out of these times and it created these times. Darwin claimed that life arose spontaneously in a, quote, warm pond. So his grandfather believed life began in the ocean, and Charles believed that life began in the warm pond. And he didn't tell us how the warm pond came or anything else. And then slowly that first creature evolved into all the creatures through the process of natural selection. In 1871, Darwin published The Descent of Man. And in that book, he said that man came from the apes. Man came from the apes. He said, man is descended from a hairy, tailed quadruped, the progenitor of the New World monkeys. So man came out of the monkey kingdom. David Strauss over in Germany, the modernist, the philosopher, said that Darwin did more than all the philosophers and critics to destroy the Bible's authority. And that's certainly true. David Strauss was happy about that. And then there was Thomas Huxley. We're just giving us some highlights of this theory and the prominent men. And Thomas Huxley was Darwin's bulldog. That's what he's called, Darwin's bulldog. Because Charles Darwin was a meek and mild-mannered man. He didn't like to speak in public. He didn't like to appear in public. He was a very private man. He loved to be out at his home, fiddling around with his scientific research. And he didn't like fights. He didn't like arguments. But Huxley loved fights. And so he went on lecture tours, and he had big meetings to promote Darwin's. And he had debates. He was a great debater. And he had debates with men who wanted to defend the Bible. And he's the one that coined the term agnostic. Means, I don't know if there's a God, and I don't know that you can know. Agnostic. Gnostic means knowledge. A means no knowledge. As to God, we just don't know. Which is nonsense, because there's clear evidence for God, no matter what Huxley says. Paul, who was a genius, said in Romans 1:18, that the creation speaks so clearly of God, of an infinite God, that men are without excuse in believing, in not believing. And Paul was right and Huxley was wrong. And along that time, the British Museum of Natural History was opened in 1881. It's a magnificent place. It really is. But it's a church of unbelief. It was called a cathedral of natural history. A cathedral is a church, a place of worship. But it was founded on Darwinian evolution. The Museum of Natural History, hundreds of thousands of children have gone through there, gone through that museum. And what have they learned? Evolution. It's full of lies. Full of lies. It has images of the supposed ape men. But there was no ape men. No ape men has ever existed. There's men and there's apes, but there's never been an ape man. And yet there's models there that they're apes, but they look like men also. But it's the figment of someone's imagination. There's no such thing. It's a lie. And yet children look at that and say, well, it must be true. Man came from the apes. And then you go to another section and they have the evolution of the whale and over in a corner, and then they have a huge whale, actual skeleton of a huge whale. It's massive. It would take many, many of these rooms to put that whale in. And then over in a corner you have a little wolf-like creature, looks like a wolf or a dog. And it says, this was the first whale. And they think, and the children look at that, and they, I don't know what they think, but they believe this has to be true. It's in this huge museum, the greatest museum in England and maybe the whole world, Museum of Natural History. And all the great museums of natural history are like that. They are places to indoctrinate people in evolution. And you go over here, and it shows the fossils. Fossilized fish and the fossilized various things. And then you have teaching there about this, and it says this happened over millions of years. But nothing is fossilized over millions of years. Either it's fossilized almost immediately or it just rots and disappears. Fish don't fossilize. If a fish dies, it just is eaten up. It's gone. Within hours or days anyway. There's no such thing as natural fossilization. These fossil beds obviously happened during a dramatic event like the global flood. And so the British Museum of Natural History and began to preach evolution to the masses of people. And this was the time when the British Empire was at its greatest. The British Empire, this is the Victorian age. Queen Victoria lived during most of the 1800s. She died, I think, in 1899. Queen Victoria died. Right at the end of the 1800s, she died. And that was the end of the, quote, Victorian age. But that was the time of the British Empire's great extent. Britain ruled the world. And so people would come from all over the world to this huge British Museum of Natural History. And what would they learn? Evolution. Darwinian evolution. And this evolutionary thinking spread all through the Church of England. Westcott and Hort, who were the main editors of the New Greek New Testament in 1881, upon which the modern versions are founded, they believed in evolution. Frederick Temple, Archbishop of Canterbury, believed in evolution. Darwin is buried in Westminster Abbey. I've seen his tomb. Westminster Abbey is the main church of the Church of England. It's the main church. And there's Charles Darwin, complete unbeliever, buried there. And that is the merging of evolution with Christianity. And over in Germany, there was Ernst Haeckel promoting evolution in Germany and beyond. He's still influential today. He grew up a Christian. When he was young, he rejected the faith of his Christian parents. He rejected the Bible. He rejected the God of the Bible. He rejected the major teachings of the Bible, such as the blood atonement and bodily resurrection of Christ, the virgin birth. Haeckel said, for me, the value of Darwin is that the human no longer needs to have a supernatural soul. Haeckel loved Charles Darwin because he believed that Charles Darwin had actually destroyed the idea of God, and that man is made in the image of God. That's why he loved Darwin. Haeckel developed a religion of nature, and of course that's Hinduism. All this stuff is Hinduism, fundamentally. Pantheism, the humanistic philosophies, the transcendentalist, it's all coming back to Hinduism. And he believed that religion of nature would eventually destroy Christianity. And he envisioned a time when there were not churches anymore, no more churches, just worship of nature. And he loved Venus, the goddess Venus. Just a bunch of nonsense, an unbeliever. And he was a liar. He was a university professor in Germany, but he was a total liar. He was the one who made this embryo chart. He's the one that made the embryo chart, which is still used in schools today. In Nepal, they are used. This chart is used. Now, he made a chart that supposedly showed what he's trying to prove is that in the beginning, as they're developing in the womb, man looks just like a fish, looks just like a frog. Everything looks the same because that is showing our evolutionary progress. And so he made this chart to prove that. He said, here are the embryos of the fish and the salamander and the turtle and the chicken, he said, and the rabbit and man. He said, see, they're all exactly the same because they all came from the same thing and then gradually evolved. And so only later in the womb did they become different. Well, that's a total lie. That's not what these embryos look like. Here's what they actually look like. Here's what they look like. They're totally different. He made his own drawings. He was an artist. Total lie. He said that's what they look like. They don't look like that. They look like this. They don't look anything the same at any point. These are the actual photos. Still used as evidence for evolution. Still used today. I read a report about that recently. I've seen how they're used in Nepali schools. I have the textbooks. But I've seen recently in some other place they're still being used. Even though it's been known ever since Haeckel's day that this is a lie. But since evolution has no real evidence, they have to use lies. Ernst Haeckel. So Darwinian evolution, and it's spread everywhere. Even most Christians believe in evolution. They don't believe in a six-day creation. They believe that things evolved over a long period of time. The greatest heroes of Christianity today, like Billy Graham, or the Pope, or any of them, they believe in evolution, some kind of evolution. They do not believe in a six-day creation. And so I'm thankful for those ministries that have come up in the last few decades, the creationist movement, which is scientists who believe the Bible and have defended the Bible, such as Answers in Genesis in Kentucky. And they have their creation museum, which gives tons of evidence for creation. And then they have the Ark Experience, which is a life-size model of the Ark. It's very amazing. And these ministries have done a lot to help God's people be confident that the Bible is actually true. And then there's Marxism. Marxism. Historian Paul Johnson believes that Karl Marx had more impact on events in men's minds. This is a very bold statement, but I think it's true. Paul Johnson was a great historian. I'm not sure if he's still alive. But he believed that Karl Marx had more impact on events and men's minds than any other intellectual in modern times. Karl Marx. In 1848, and so we're talking about the same period, mid-1800s. 1800s, all these things coming. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels published the Communist Manifesto in London. Communist Manifesto. Karl Marx was a Jew, an unbelieving Jew, a God-hater. Oh my, he was a God-hater. But Marxism, what is it? It is a movement toward a supposed utopia by means of a communist revolution. I think that's a good definition. Marxism is a movement toward a supposed utopia, some kind of perfect society, utopia, by the means of a communist revolution. So first you have to tear down before you can build up the perfect society. You have to destroy the present society. So communists don't care what they destroy. They don't care if they destroy the economy. They don't care if they destroy the government. They don't care if they destroy people. When the Maoists tried to take over Nepal, they didn't care who they killed. And they didn't build anything, but they destroyed tons of things. They destroyed bridges. They destroyed electric towers. They destroyed electric generators. And they killed thousands and thousands of people. Especially they killed teachers, government people. Marxism. Marxism is what produced Maoism. Mao Zedong was a Marxist. He had his own kind of Marxism, but he was a Marxist. It promises a utopia on earth wherein everyone is equal and everything is distributed equally. That's the idea. Of course, it's not possible because man is a selfish sinner. And man is never going to love his neighbor as himself. That's ridiculous. Man is going to live for himself because that's what man is by nature. Marxism denies human nature and claims that man can actually become good through the Marxist plan. It's a lie. It's based upon a lie. And it's produced nothing but destruction and confusion. But that's the promise, utopia on earth. And the path is a Marxist revolution. And so, Marx divided society into the oppressors. He called them the bourgeois. Bourgeois, French term. First time I heard about Marxism was a friend in the army of Vietnam. And he was a college graduate, very intellectual man. But he was in the army, drafted, forced to be in the army. But he loved to talk about Marxism. And I liked to talk to him, but I didn't have to know what he was talking about. But he talked about the bourgeois and the proletariat. And so the bourgeois is the high class of society. The wealthy, the property owners, business owners, educators, bourgeois. And the proletariat are the oppressed class. He divided society into two classes. And of course, society is not two classes. It's a whole bunch of classes. But that's what he did. The proletariat are the workers, the common man. Common man. And so Marx called for the workers, the proletariat, to overthrow the bourgeois, destroy them, and establish a dictatorship of the proletariat, dictatorship of the common man. I'm trying to make Marxism simple. And really, fundamentally, it is. It's all about revolution. Destruction and replacing the present society with a new utopia. And so first of all, the common man has to rebel against the rulers, the ruling class, the bourgeois, and overthrow them and destroy them and take their property and take their power. And then there will be the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's what will happen next. According to Marx, this has never actually happened. This was his plan, his theory. And then that was supposed to lead somehow to a classless society in which everybody's the same and everybody shares everything and everybody lives very happily together. That was his idea. Of course, no such thing has ever existed on earth since Adam and Eve rebelled against God. And it cannot. A utopia cannot come back to earth until man's sin, man gets right with God, and Christ comes. And so Marxism is at war with capitalism. Marxism is at war with so-called capitalism. These are some fundamentals of Marxism. And capitalism is, quote, an economic system based on the private ownership of the means of production and distribution of goods, characterized by a free competitive market and motivation by profit. And the reason that capitalism is good is that man is selfish. And man has to have a profit motive. If I'm going to work, I've got to have a profit. Otherwise, I'm not going to work. If I work and everything goes to somebody else, why should I work? If we're all together and one man works harder and another man's lazy, but they all get the same, well, the man that works hard is not going to work hard very long. He's going to get lazy like the other man, because that's human nature and it's common sense. Communism never works, never ever works. When the Jews started coming back into Israel in the early 20th century, and they formed these communes, these kibbutzes, communes is what they were. But these people were coming mostly from Europe, and they were Marxists, these Jews, these early Jews. They were Marxists. They had communist thinking, and they thought, well, we will make little communist farms, and we'll all work, and we'll share everything together. Everyone will get the same. No one will get any more. If you're a genius and you have a PhD, you won't get any more than the man that digs ditches. All the same. If you're a hard worker, well, you get the same as the man over here that doesn't work too hard. It didn't work. And they had to change that system. So that today the kibbutzes operate on a capitalistic basis. Means if you work hard, you get more. If you get more education and you know more, you get more. If you become an engineer and you know how to do better things, then you get more. And that's the only system that works for man. And that was proven in Israel. And anyway, it's been proven. Everywhere communism has been tried, it's failed. And it's only brought destruction. Oh, such destruction. But Marxism is at war with capitalism. Marxism is a system of socialism of which the dominant feature is public ownership of the means of production, distribution, and exchange. Now, this is also a fundamental of Marxism. It is public ownership of the means of production and distribution of goods. Everything is owned publicly. The farms, the electric plants, everything is owned by the public rather than private ownership, which is capitalism. And it's called socialism. But in practice, public ownership means government ownership. If things are not owned by private individuals, then they're owned by the government. They're owned by the government. And that's what communism does. It exalts the government and makes the government very powerful over the people. That's what it always does. And that's what's happening in the West. That's what's happening in America and England and those Western nations, Germany. Communism is destroying the capitalist system, making the government like God, and therefore the people's private rights are taken away. It's called socialism. Marxism uses the power of the government to create its promised utopia. It's called socialism. In the report, Marxism, the good, the bad, and why the good is actually bad, by the organization Standing for Freedom, I'm thankful that there are many, many organizations and institutions in America and in England, but mostly America, that are very wise about the dangers of communism and that produce a lot of good education about this. And there's even universities and colleges privately owned that that educate very well against Marxism and socialism, because most of the universities and colleges in the West teach Marxism. And yet there's still a lot of good education that's available against Marxism, and I'm thankful for that. Especially in America. America's still a very free nation, and it's got a free press, and if you believe something, you can still publish it, and you can still start a school and teach it. You can start a magazine, or you can publish a book. There's that kind of freedom, which doesn't exist in many parts of the world, of course. You can't do that in China. When communism comes, people's rights are destroyed. In China, you cannot publish what you want to publish. I was talking to Isabella recently. She's from Singapore. She has friends in China. She is Chinese, speaks Chinese. And the churches in China, they have a very hard, they have great difficulty just getting online and doing anything because the government is in control. Communism. So Marxism came. And it came at a time when the lower classes, the common man, was very oppressed. Very oppressed. The Industrial Revolution created these massive factories. Before the Industrial Revolution, everything was made by hand, and clothes. Clothes were made by hand. People had to sew the dress, had to, you know, cut out the material, make the material, cut out the material, sew the dress, sew the pants, one by one. And then these great machines came, steam driven at first, and these huge factories were building with these huge steam engines. And these machines could make thousands of dresses or pants or whatever in one day. And so the people, they hired people, but they gave them almost nothing. And they required that the people work 17 hours a day. And then they required little children to work. They didn't have to, but there wasn't any other jobs available, because the big factories destroyed the small businesses. Still happening today. And so the common man was very oppressed. He didn't get much money. His working conditions were horrible. They were basically slaves to the factory owners. They weren't actually slaves, but if you can't get another job, then basically you are a slave. You have to accept whatever the owner gives you if you don't have any other job available. And that was the time that Marxism became popular in it, and the people thought, hey, that's a great idea. These factory owners, they own everything. They get all the money. We get nothing. Let's overthrow them. It was very popular. Within a year after the publication of the Communist Manifesto, within a year after 1848, January 1848, over 50 violent attempts took place to topple the governments. And there was a third French Revolution. And these Marxist movements spread across Europe and England and America. And they were disguised as labor movements, union movements. And the Marxists would come in and they would stir up the workers and they would say, you need to get a lot more money. In fact, you need to own part of this business. Why should the owner have everything? You should have part of it. And they would stir up the people and get them angry. And man's easily stirred up because he's selfish. And so they would start killing and trying to overthrow the companies. Labor movement. These Marxist movements. In 1917, the communist revolutionaries gained control of Russia. Lenin, Stalin. That's when Russia became communist. And eventually that created the Soviet Union. In 1948, Kim Il-sung established a communist state in North Korea. 1948. Same year that Israel became a modern nation. 1949, Mao Zedong founded the People's Republic of China. 1949, year I was born. 1959, Fidel Castro founded a communist state in Cuba. And this swept across the world. Communism. What about Karl Marx? He was raised a Lutheran. He was raised in a Christian home. In fact, at age 17, he wrote, "The Union of the Faithful with Christ." The union of the faithful with Christ. The faithful believer. 17 years old, he said, "Through love of Christ, we turn our hearts at the same time toward our brethren who are inwardly bound to us and for whom he gave himself a sacrifice." At that time, that teenager, Karl Marx believed in the blood atonement of Christ and the unity in love of the brethren in Christ. Not long afterwards, he rejected everything. And he became a hater of God. Marx's heart was filled with rage. He was an angry, angry, angry man. And that corrupted his whole life. And it permeated his writings, his anger. We read, this is an excellent book too, "Apostate, the Men Who Destroyed the American West" by Swanson. Excellent book. But he said Marx's life was filled with violent, explosive arguments with his family, which led to complete breach of relationship with his mother and occasional separations from his wife. He couldn't get along with anybody. He was angry, raging at everybody. According to Jenny, his wife, his life was one continual fight. One of his acquaintances described Marx in a poem. He said, "Marx, dark fellow from Trier, in fury raging. His evil fist is clenched. He roars interminably, as though 10,000 devils had him by the hair." That's how one of his friends described Marx. And Paul Johnson, the historian, in the book Intellectuals, said Marx's pent-up rage, therefore, passed into his books. Many passages give the impression that they've actually been written in a state of fury. In due course, Lenin, Stalin, and Mao Zedong practiced on an enormous scale the violence which Marx felt in his heart and which his works exude. And so, whoever you read and listen to, they're going to affect you. And that anger which permeated Marx's writings is what produced communist hateful revolutions. Millions have died. Millions. Stalin murdered millions by starving them to death. So did Mao. Millions. Marx was a complete hypocrite. He wrote about capital, money, but he didn't understand it. He never held a job. He lived off the welfare of others and borrowing. He never held a job. Couldn't work. Didn't work. Refused to work. And when people did not give him money, he railed at them. He wrote about the liberation of workers, but he knew nothing about workers. And he cared nothing about workers. He wrote about the creation of the new man, but he was a miserable, corrupt, cruel man who didn't even love his own wife and children. But he's talking about creating a new man. Total hypocrite. In a report by Lawrence Reed, Paul Johnson, on why we should beware intellectuals, we should beware intellectuals because they're usually haters of God and the Bible. He's describing Marx. On a good day, he enjoyed threatening those who disagreed with him by blurting, "I will annihilate you. I will annihilate you. I will destroy you." His personal hygiene was, well, suffice it to say, he didn't have any. He was stinking because he never bathed. A stinking man. He was heartlessly cruel to his family and to anyone who crossed him. This is the same man who postured as a thinker whose ideas would save humanity. His most famous lines, including "religion is the opiate of the masses," that's what he said, "religion is the opiate of the masses," and "workers have nothing to lose but their chains," were flagrantly ripped off from other authors. He stole those sayings from other men and gave them no credit. He was a thief. He never set foot in a mill or a factory or a mine or other industrial workplace in the whole of his life. And when he was invited to do so, he refused. He never let a fact or glimmer of reality stem the flow of poison from his pen. Poison. He had no money because he refused to work for it. Then he cursed those who had it and didn't share it with him. His own mother said she wished her son would, quote, "accumulate some capital instead of just writing about it." That was clever. I wish he would make some money instead of just writing about it. What emerges from a reading of Capital, Marx's book, is Marx's fundamental failure to understand capitalism. He didn't understand it. And yet he's writing about it. Marx failed precisely because he was unscientific. He would not investigate the facts himself or use objectively the facts investigated by others. He didn't care about facts. From start to finish, not just Capital, his main book, but all his books, all his work reflects a disregard for truth, which at times amounts to contempt. He didn't care anything about truth. This is the primary reason why Marxism as a system cannot produce the results claimed for it, and to call it scientific is preposterous. Karl Marx's life was a disaster. He had 7 children by his wife, Jenny. And then he had a child out of wedlock by his housemaid. He was an adulterer. He didn't care anything about God's laws. His favorite daughter, Eleanor, his favorite daughter, married Edward Aveling, a Satanist known for his blasphemous lectures, quote, "on the wickedness of God." This man wrote about the wickedness of God. He says God is wicked and Satan is good. And that's who Eleanor, Marx's favorite daughter, married. Marx starved 3 of his children to death. The 2 daughters who outlived him committed suicide. And so his whole family was a disaster because of his anger and wickedness. His whole family was destroyed. Marx hated the Jews. It's very important to understand that Marx hated Jews. Marx was a Jew, but Marx hated Jews. And he wanted to see them destroyed. He called them terrible names. Marx wrote, "The fact that the Jews of the world have become so strong as to endanger the life of the world causes us to disclose their organization, their purpose, that its stench might awaken the workers of the world to fight and eliminate such a canker." What? Eliminate the Jews. And so Hitler came along a little bit later and tried to do that. Marx loved Darwin's theory of evolution. He called it the basis of natural history for our view. He believed that Darwin gave him a good foundation for his theory of Marxism. Marx and God. He hated God. He blasphemed God. He said, "I wish to avenge myself against the one who rules above." He said, "I am great like God," in one of his poems. The poem sent to his father on his 55th birthday. This is what he said to his father, "I am great like God." His father was a Christian. Marx's play, Ol Anim, something like that, Ol Anim, called for the destruction of the world. The destruction of the world. He considered religion the opiate of the people. He hated the very idea of God. He said the idea of God is a limitation to human development. If men would just throw away that idea of God, they would make good progress. And communism has always hated God and tried to destroy Christianity. The Soviet Union did that. The North Koreans have done that. China is trying to, has always tried to do that to various degrees. And then Marx understood the power of education. Education is the main tool that Marxism uses to spread its theory. Public education. Public education. And Marx knew that the only way to brainwash the children is to control their education. Before 1848, very little education was a product of the government. Most education was not public government education before 1848. For thousands of years, education was considered a responsibility of parents, churches, and small communities, and was carried out under their direction. That's the way it was in America for a very long time, until the late 1800s. Karl Marx perceives that the family and its commitment to direct the education of its children is the major impediment to the Marxist state. And so that's still the main way that Marxism is spread, through public education. Marxism is elitist. It claims to be a movement of the common man, but it always starts in the universities and colleges, the intellectuals. It's elitist. And they believe that they are superior, and the rules they make don't apply to them. And so they actually just use the common people as their tools of revolution. It's an elitist movement. Marxism is destructive. Wherever Marx's philosophy has operated, it has produced turmoil, hatred, variance, violence, and death. Kevin Swanson, in the book Apostate, The Men Who Destroyed the Christian West, said, "Given that Marx's ideological progeny includes the likes, includes Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Cambodia, Fidel Castro, there's no other man in recorded human history responsible for as many deaths as Marx. He's called the humanist of the humanist of the humanists, Marx. The total number of citizens killed by the Roman emperors is estimated to have been between 2 and 8 million over a period of 400 years. 2 to 8 million by the Roman emperors. Yet, this is just a fraction of the number of lives lost under Marx's ideologies in the 20th century. Thus far, the body count lies between 85 million and 200 million. Between 85 and 200 million people have died through Marxist revolutions. It's destructive. And yet, Marxism is still a major world philosophy. We're looking at some fundamental points about Marxism. Marxism is still a fundamental world philosophy today, in spite of all the deaths, in spite of the fact that it's never worked, in spite of the fact that it always puts people into bondage to the government. It's still a major world philosophy. And about 20% of the world's population still lives under communist governments, like especially in China and North Korea. And Marxism is still taught under many different names in universities and colleges and public schools around the world. And then we would say one more point about Marxism is that it has morphed into many philosophies. It's constantly changing different names, different ideas, but fundamentally the same. A utopia. We're going to have a utopia through a revolution. We're going to have to divide everyone. We're going to have to destroy things. We're going to have to get society all fighting in turmoil so we can have our utopia. We're going to have to destroy property and things and people if they get in the way. But it has many different forms. And in recent decades in the West, one of the major forms of communism is called the critical race theory. Critical race theory. It's very big now in America. It's causing a lot of destruction. Black Lives Matter is founded on the critical race theory. And the aim of this kind of Marxism, social Marxism, is to create a society in which the Bible is gone. That's the idea. A society in which the Bible's gone and people don't have to worry about obeying the Bible. They can live as they please. They can be whatever they want. If they want to be, if a man wants to be a woman, that's okay. Whatever you want to be, you can be that, and however you want to live, you can live like that. And what is that? That is a total rebellion against God and the Bible. Critical race theory. And so it divides people. It's Marxism. It tries to divide people and get people angry at one another. Divide men from women. And everybody divided. And poor people from rich people and blacks from whites and divide everybody. Because that's the way you destroy, and then you can build a new society. Well, America was founded on the Bible, and so those people that believed the critical race theory, the Black Lives Matter and other people, all through the universities they believed this, they hate the old America that was built on the Bible. They hate it. They hate it. They hate the founders of America. They hate George Washington and these men that created America. And so this is what's happening in the West now. And we have more in the text about this. Critical race theory. Black Lives Matter is one of the proponents of this. And it's causing a lot of destruction in America, and it's causing tremendous divisions. Tremendous divisions. And destructions. Their goal is to destroy the old America.